So I'm gonna do the, I'm gonna be the convener, which I'm told by Greg means nothing. I get to simply have us introduce ourselves to each other, and once we have done that, we get to elect a chair for this meeting and for the next 2 weeks. So, and I'll say that on the record here when Greg tells me to go ahead and do that. But I think everybody ought to give a little fulsome introduction of themselves. I mean, you know, not just, you know, my name is Bill Donahue, and you know, what did you do? You know, why are you here? You know, were you the king of Minnesota, or whatever you were. So,
we can start.
Okay, good enough. Okay, my name is Bill Donahue, and Greg has asked me to be the convener of this session. Tom is out of the state and is not here to do that duty. So I am told to tell you that being convener means nothing. It is simply my duty to have us introduce each other and have a little discussion about who will actually be the chair of the committee. And if any of you want to be chair or you think somebody would be a good chair, you should speak up. The only preliminaries I would say are that our job here, as I understand it, is by March 31st, we have to prescribe salaries and we have to provide a report for our reasons. And the March 31st deadline is both in the statute and in the Constitution, and so we don't have any leeway. We will be done on March 31st. And as I understand it, we have three scheduled meetings, and the things we're required to do, as from my read, is that we have to take into account other compensation received by legislators, and Greg will help us address that. And we have to take into account the most recent budget forecast. And I know that the forecast just came out yesterday, and my understanding is we will have a presentation about that at the next meeting. So we'll have more detail about that. So there are three meetings, and that's it. You know, and let's introduce ourselves. I'll go first. I'm Bill Donahue. I live in St. Paul. I was a lawyer at the University of Minnesota for years. So, and I was appointed by Lori Gilday to the commission. And in terms of being the chair of this, my only reservation about doing that is that I'm not going to be here from the 14th of March until the 22nd of March. So I'm going to miss the second meeting, and I'll be gone for what I see as a critical period of time. So, okay, let's do this. Deborah, why don't we go around this way?
I'm Deborah Olson.
But some participants may be experiencing temporary audio issues. Our teams are working to resolve this as quickly as possible.
Thank you.
Is anyone on the phone?
Hey, yeah.
Okay, well, good.
You're still there. This is Laura.
My name is Deborah Olson. I live in Eden Prairie. I also was appointed by the Chief Justice. I'm a retired chair and CEO of Nelson Laboratories, which was a business in the animal health industry, operated in 17 states in the upper Midwest. I've also worked in the telecommunications, sports, and government.
I'm Gloria Myrie. I live in Apple Valley, and I, too, was appointed by Chief Justice Gilday. Until recently, I was a partner at Barnes & Thornburg practicing in the area of family law, and I recently moved over to St. Thomas Law School. I now serve as their Director of Alumni Engagement and Student Life.
I'm Sherry Pugh, and I was appointed by Governor Dayton, and I've retired from working 35 years in the community economic development field and live in Mound, Minnesota.
I'm Marcia Vandenberg, and I was appointed by Governor Dayton, and I live in Oak Grove, which is northwest of Anoka, and I own a small business that I run in the poultry industry.
James Joy, I was appointed by Chief Justice. I own two businesses. I am currently the mayor of Holly, city of Minnesota Social Small Cities.
I'm Diana Burleson. I'm from Sauk Rapids, Minnesota. I was appointed by the Chief Justice. I'm retired from St. Cloud State University.
I'm Joseph Boyle. I'm from International Falls. I practice law up there. And I was originally appointed by Governor Dayton, and I was reappointed by Governor Walz.
I'm Charles McRoy. practiced as a CPA for 40 years in Minneapolis until I hit our firm's mandatory retirement age. Firm Clifton Larson Allen, live in Minneapolis, and presently sit on the Minnesota State Board of Accounts.
Over here.
I'm Randy Twistle from Thief River Falls. I was appointed by Governor Dayton. I'm a human resource guy. Been doing that for 21 years with kind of a focus on compensation and benefits.
Okay.
I'm Ken Walmus from Mankato. I was appointed by the Chief Justice, and I owned and operated a steel manufacturing business for 33 years, and I'm semi-retired, still work there part-time.
Okay, on the phone, Dave Metzen, why don't you introduce yourself?
Dave Metzen, currently in Mazatlan, Mexico, this afternoon. Appointed by Governor Dayton and spent most of my life in education and got to know Bill Donahue very well. He did a heck of a job for the university. Bill, thank you for kicking us off.
And Greg Fox? Greg, you still there?
Greg Fox. I am. You know, though, we got cut off for a little while. I heard most of the introductions, but we may have to call in at some point, because at one time it was just three or four of us listening to each other and not the meeting. I'm from Duluth. I was the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Operations at UMD for a long time. Yeah, I was appointed by Chief Justice Gilday. And I'm looking forward to getting back to work together.
Laura Witte?
Yes, hello. I'm Laura Witte. I'm from St. Peter, which is District 1. I was appointed by Governor Dayton. I'm currently an accounting supervisor for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota.
Okay. And Tom Stinson?
I'm Tom Stinson. I live in Roseville, although for several months of the year, I now live in Scottsdale, Arizona. I was appointed by Governor Dayton and reappointed by Governor Walz. I was state economist and a professor at the university. I'm now retired.
And is Patty Hanna on the phone? Okay. So I think that's everybody. And why don't you folks introduce yourselves so that people can know who we are. Greg?
I'm Greg Hippinger. I work for the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and we help staff this council.
I'm Angie Behrens. I'm with the Attorney General's Office, so I'll be here for legal questions.
And I'm Sally Olson with the Legislative Coordinating Commission as well.
And are the rest of you staffers or just observers?
I'm presenting, so I can
introduce
myself.
Okay. Good enough. So that's it. We need to, the first order of business is to elect somebody to actually chair the meeting, and there are three meetings to be chaired. And I've told you about sort of my role in this. Is that I'm a little reluctant to be the chair only because I won't be here for 10 days, and I won't be here for the second meeting. So is there anybody else who is interested or willing to be chair, and or do you want to nominate somebody to be chair?
I'm willing to serve. I've run plenty of meetings in business and nonprofits.
Okay.
Other people, come on. Step up.
Others. Others. Gloria?
No, thanks. I think Deborah would do a great job.
I second that.
Good enough. Others? Others? Okay, and then we also need a vice chair, and I think we'll vote first on the chair, and then we'll vote on the vice chair. Anybody on the phone interested in nominating somebody or being the chair of the Legislative Salary Council? I hear.
No, thank you.
It wasn't an offer. All right. Good enough. So we have.
Is anyone else interested in being vice chair, though?
Right. Well, are there vice chair candidates? Anybody want to be vice chair?
I nominate Dr. Dave Metzen as vice chair.
All right. David, are you willing to be vice chair?
Absolutely, sure.
And will you be?
Dave's willing to work with me. I'm willing to work with her.
You can work successfully with Deborah Olson?
Oh, absolutely. We've done it before.
Yeah, okay. Good enough. Hearing no other nominations or suggestions, let's have a roll call vote, I guess, is what we have to do.
Mr. Chair, because members are participating by phone under the open meeting law, all votes have to be done by a roll call.
All right.
If we want to try to expedite things, if we can combine things, if there's no controversy about who's being elected to office,
that
we could have one motion for both positions.
A slate of officers is often done that way.
Sure, let's do that. So if somebody make a motion that we elect Deborah Olson chair and David Metzen vice chair.
I motion.
Second.
Okay. And we'll have a roll call vote on that, I guess.
Yeah, and Sally will pick the roll.
All right, good enough.
Bill Boyle.
Yes.
Diana Burleson.
Yes.
Bill Donahue.
Yes.
Greg Fox.
Greg, are you there?
Yeah.
He's got his phone on mute.
I don't know if you heard me.
Did you say yes?
Yes.
Good.
Patty Hannon. James Joy.
Yes.
Chaz McElroy.
Yes.
Dave Metzen.
Yes.
Gloria Myrie.
Yes.
Deborah Olson.
Yes.
Sherry Pugh.
Yes.
Tom Stinson.
Yes.
Randy Twistoff.
Yes.
Marsha Vandenberg.
Yes.
Ken Wilmus.
Yes.
Laura Whitty.
Yes.
Okay, it seems to me that it's unanimous, and therefore I will give to Deborah the tentative agenda.
I've got it.
She already has it.
All right, so the first order of business then is to adopt the agenda. So does anyone have any questions, comments, or problems with the agenda? And I need a motion to approve.
So moved.
Second.
We need to do the roll call on this also. Go ahead.
No. Joe Boyle.
Yes.
Diana Burleson.
Yes.
Bill Donahue.
Yes.
Greg Fox.
Yes.
Patty Hannon. James Joy.
Yes.
Chaz McElroy.
Yes.
Dave Metzen.
Yes.
Gloria Myrie.
Yes.
Deborah Olson.
Yes.
Sherry Pugh.
Yes.
Tom Stinson.
Yes.
Randy Twistoff.
Yes.
Marsha Vandenberg.
Yes.
Ken Wilmus.
Yes.
Laura Whitty.
Yes.
All right, the motion is approved. The next item on the agenda is the administrative matters, so I will turn it over to Sally.
So, first of all, meeting location. This is the only time we'll be in this location. It was really hard to get a room on the Capitol complex, so we had to, the DOT was nice enough to loan us this room, but with the security stuff, we know that's not the easiest. So the next couple meetings will be out in those meeting rooms out in the main area of the DOT, which doesn't need a badge or it's easily accessed to the public. The other thing is you should all be familiar with the expense reimbursement process. In your packets are the forms. Try and complete those at before the end of the meeting if you can. I know with hotel it gets tricky, but if you can, and so Chair Olson can sign off on those. If you have any questions regarding that, just catch me after the meeting. Also, speak loudly since we're not mic'd. This is being recorded, and the recording will be posted to our website. I think that's it.
Any questions for Sally? The next item is the Open Meeting Laws and Data Practices Act, and Stacy will make a presentation.
All right, hello everybody, and this will be a review. You have all heard this before, so certainly if you have any questions, I will go over this fairly quickly just because you have heard this before, but certainly ask me any questions as they come up or as you kind of had discussions about things over the last couple of years. I believe I was here 2 years ago sharing this information. So let me know. I'm Stacy Christensen. I'm the director of the Data Practices Office in the Department of Administration. And a little bit.
Those of you on the phone, is Stacy speaking loud enough for you to hear?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
I talk loud.
If the technology technology doesn't work, you all have the handouts. So, well, I skipped my slide. So, the second slide, a little bit about who we are and what we do. We are a small office within the Department of Administration that provides technical assistance on both the data practices and open meeting law. The bulk of what we do is answer questions from the government, the public, the legislature, and the media on both of those laws. We have a website with a lot of information. The formal work that we do is do the staffing and drafting of advisory opinions on both of the laws for the Commissioner of Administration's approval. And those are all on our website as well. So a lot of issues have been dealt there. We also, of course, do training and present information to groups such as this. So why is government data practices important? You all know this. This is a review for you. But it's really about transparency. It's about the public being able to know, hear, understand what government's doing, why they're doing what they're doing. And in terms of Minnesota, you know, we're a bit unique among the other states in the federal government because we presume everything is public unless the legislature says something is not public. Or the federal law says that something is not public. So really the bulk of what you are working with as members of this council is going to be public government data. Okay, so our law also is unique because we combine both transparency and public records rights with privacy rights of individuals. So it defines government data, it tells us what we have, what we're doing with it, it presumes the data are public. It classifies, what classifies means it protects certain data, but it also gives rights to data subjects. So when the government collects data about individuals, it gives them rights to make sure that the data are accurate, complete, and current. It gives them a right to know when the government is collecting it, why they're collecting it, what they're going to do with it, that sort of thing. And the kind of an important thing to remember is the Data Practices Act only applies to government entities, which is a defined term, and it does not apply to the legislature or the courts. So it's really those executive branch agencies, cities, counties, school district, municipal type government that it applies to. A couple of other important laws to keep in mind, the Official Records Act and Records Management Statute. Those laws basically say government has to create official records so the public knows what government is doing and understands why they're doing it. Also to pass that information on to successors in office so government employees aren't constantly reinventing the wheel. And the records management statute says that government has to come up with records retention schedules for their data. And it dictates how long data or official records are to be retained and kind of what the classifications are around those official records. Neither of those laws define official records, so that's going to be up to each entity to determine what is just being maintained as government data and what is being maintained as an official record that is subject to the retention schedule. Government data are everything that are recorded in some form. The only thing that government data do not include are a government entity's thoughts, which was litigated, surprisingly enough. But anytime a government employee writes something down, drafts an email, records a video, those data are government data subject to the Data Practices Act. Talked about a classification of government data, and that's the way that the approach the legislature took to say what is public and what is not public. This chart just highlights the three types of classifications. It differentiates data on individuals versus data not on individuals, which would be like businesses or things that the government collects data about. But really the important classifications are public, private and confidential. Public data are available to anyone for any reason. A government entity can't ask why someone is requesting public data. They can't ask who they are when they're requesting public data. Private data is what has more protection around it. That is data on individuals that are not available to the public. So if the member of the public is requesting data that are private, the government cannot provide those data to the public. And they would have to ask for some identifying information from a data subject because they do have access to their own private data. Confidential is a stricter level of classification. That means that the data subject does not have access to those data. And those are really going to be any type of investigative data that will be confidential while the investigation is ongoing, and then will revert to public generally when that investigation is complete. So this slide, you all are probably done with. If you decide to adopt those policies that you adopted the last time around, the responsible authority is Greg, if you so select him to be again, as well as the data practices compliance official. So those are two roles that the Data Practices Act requires each entity to have, as well as two required policies, which I believe is the next item on your agenda, that details responding to public data requests and responding to requests from data subjects. So those are two policies that the statute requires that I believe you are all in a really good position at this point. So data about you. So we're always interested, okay, how does this impact me as a member of the council? You know, what should I be kind of thinking about? As an appointee to a public body, Section 13.601 applies to you, and some are public and some are private. So I listed the public data in the bullets on the slide, your name and address, training and background. I don't expect that there would be existence and status of complaints, but if there's some sort of investigation, it would reach into that as well. I think the important thing to remember is kind of your use of your laptops or smartphones or any sort of technology and how you are using those when you are doing the work of the council. So any council-related data on those devices are going to be government data subject to the Data Practices Act. However, that doesn't pull your entire personal email account under the operation of the Data Practices Act. It would just be those particular emails or text messages that you're sending related to the work of the council. So something to be aware of. All right, I'm moving on to the open meeting law, unless anyone, yeah.
Yeah, does the Data Practices Act apply to us?
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't apply to the legislature, and it doesn't apply to the courts.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
It does apply to us because...
Yes, and I think that that was kind of a discussion point
two years ago.
And I think that it was resolved that this council is going to act as a subject to the Data Practices Act.
I mean, I want to do that, but I just struck me that there was a legal issue there about whether or not that's actually true.
Yes, yes. It could, under the definitions, I think that it fits as one of the defined government entities, but that's a very good question. Other questions? All right, so the open meeting law, we've already experienced some of the requirements that you have related to the open meeting law with votes and other items. So I'm just going to go over kind of some of the key topics, group subjects, meeting subjects, types of meeting. I expect you will not have any closed meetings, so that's not really going to be something important to this particular council. The kind of legal basis is, and the courts have said, that with limited exception, all meetings of public bodies have to be open to the public. That means the public can attend meetings. That's pretty much what the courts have said. The courts also came up with what is called the quorum rule. This is not something that's in the language of the open meeting law. But there was some disagreement about which meetings were subjects. So back in the 80s, the courts decided that there is a meeting subject to the open meeting law if two things happen. There is a quorum or more of the full body, which would be a majority, and that quorum is discussing, deciding, or receiving information as a group relating to its official business. So those two things have to be at play for a meeting to be subject to the open meeting law. So what are these types of meetings that would be that you would have to be worried about subject to the open meeting law? The most types of meetings that public bodies have are regularly scheduled meetings, regular meetings. Those are meetings that the body comes together, their first meeting of the year, and says, this is our schedule of meetings. We're going to meet on the first Wednesday of every month from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. They set their schedule, and that is their regular meeting schedule. There is no other notice requirement other than setting that schedule and keeping it on file at the offices of the public body. And any kind of advance notice is not required. Certainly we see, such as this council is doing, posting on the website and letting the public actually know where the meetings are, where they're taking place, instead of having that paper file at the public body's primary office. The open meeting law is a very paper-based law. It hasn't been updated very much for technology, so you'll see a lot of these requirements are a bit dated. Special meetings are any meetings that are not on the regular schedule. So if you all decided you needed to have a meeting in addition to the ones that are regularly scheduled, then you would need advance notice and posting of those meetings. They had to happen 3 days before the meeting, 3 calendar days before the meeting, and they must include the date, time, place, and meeting purpose. Regular meetings do not have to include an agenda or meeting purpose, but special meetings do. Emergency meetings, I hope that you do not have to call in emergency meetings. Those are really dealing with disasters, floods, snowstorms, tornadoes, that type of thing, that don't allow for a 3-day advance notice. So those are very rare when those emergency meetings happen. Types of meetings that are not subject to the open meeting law, anytime you have less than a quorum. So two members of a public body that are speaking to each other on a 7-member council, for example, is not a meeting subject to the open meeting law. There would have to be a quorum. Chance or social gatherings, the courts have said that those types of events, such as retirement parties or sporting events that you happen to all be at as a quorum, this impacts probably public bodies more so in local communities where their kids may be on the same sports team or they're all attending the same retirement party. That is not a meeting that you would have to notice as subject to the open meeting law, as long as you don't talk about official business. So it's just really important to just attend those events for the reason you're attending the event and not start talking about official business. Then there are no open meeting law issues. Trainings, again, this is probably not going to impact this particular council, but just to let you know, some of the trainings are not subject to the open meeting law. Again, as long as the council or public body is not talking about official business. So that's really the trigger there. A few special considerations. The use of email is not addressed at all in the open meeting law. It hasn't really been addressed with kind of a definite resolution by the courts either. The commissioner issued an advisory opinion back in 2009 related to an official discussion that happened over email, and basically said because there was a quorum that was on this email sharing information with each other related to official business, that was likely a violation of the open meeting law. So that is just kind of a cautionary. Don't have official discussions where you're making a decision over email that the public isn't able to view and witness in real time. One-way communications, sending out the agenda, sending out informational materials where there's no discussion related to that, the opinion said it is not going to be a violation as long as that discussion piece doesn't happen. Serial meetings, this is something, again, that the courts have kind of carved out, the law itself doesn't address. Are those meetings less than a quorum where it looks like the members of the public body are trying to forge a majority? So two members talk to each other, and then one of those talks to a couple more, one of those talk to a couple more, and it looks like you're trying to make a decision outside of the open meeting law. The courts haven't ruled definitively on that, but they said, given the right facts and the right situation, those serial meetings might be a violation of the open meeting law. So just be careful not to have those discussions outside of your open meetings. Closed meetings, again, this is really not going to probably be applicable to you at all. The catch of this is there has to be a reason to close a meeting, a legal reason that either the open meeting law allows you to do or requires you to do, or another statute. And you have to let the public know by making a statement on the record why you're closing the meeting and what authority you have to close the meeting. As we see today, it is allowed for statewide bodies to have open meetings by telephone. So you're able to utilize that permission in the open meeting law. And then there's probably the most recent addition to the open meeting law related to social media use. It says that public bodies can use social media, public body members can use social media, but exchanges must be limited to all members of the public. So we've read that to basically mean that you have to let the public, you have to have an open Twitter account or an open Facebook account as your official kind of discussion about your role as a public body member. So that is what they've talked about with social media. There are penalties and remedies. Most of the enforcement happens through the courts. Our office does not have enforcement authority over the open meeting law. The Attorney General's office does not have authority to enforce the open meeting law. So anyone that thinks that there has been a violation basically has to go to court and make their case to a district court judge. The bottom bullet is probably the most surprising to people, that the open meeting law does not say that there must be any reversal of an action taken while there was an illegal meeting. So that's something that the courts have affirmed. The law just doesn't say, it just doesn't address that provision. Open meetings and data practices. Public bodies can discuss not public data at an open meeting if it relates to their jurisdiction, their authority, the subject matter of what they're discussing, and they are immune from liability for those discussions. The not public data retain their original classification, so just because you talk about not public data in an open meeting doesn't revert it to public, but any minutes of that meeting would be public. So it's just careful to make, public bodies need to be careful to make sure that they're including only public data in their minutes, but not public data can be discussed. All recordings of open meetings, all closed meetings have to be recorded except under the attorney-client privilege, and the access to those recordings will be based on how the data are classified under the Data Practices Act. So there could be a combination of public and not public data on those closed meeting recordings. And that is all I have, but I would love to take any questions that you all might have.
No questions, but thank you for speaking loud and clear.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The next item on the agenda is the data practices policy. Greg?
Madam Chair and members, the last organizational thing that you have to do is to adopt two policies that Stacy just mentioned in her presentation. And copies of these are in your packets. The first policy is the one titled Legislative Salary Council Data Practices Policy for Members of the Public. This is the policy that applies to how the public accesses data from the council. And this is identical to, this proposed policy is identical to the one you adopted 2 years ago. It assigns the responsibility for implementing this to staff. Madam Chair, the second policy is a second handout. It's the council policy for data practices on data subjects. This is the policy that applies to you as members of the council and how the public can access that data. We have both public and private data on you. The public data is what Stacy mentioned earlier about your addresses and names. The private data are your social security numbers that we have so that we can reimburse you for your expenses. The proposed policy, again, is the same as you adopted 2 years ago. We need to update the dates, but other than that, there aren't any proposed changes.
And in these policies, do we designate you, or is that a separate thing where we designate you as the person who is available to the public for the data practices?
Madam Chair, the policy designates me as the staff.
It does in the policies. All right. So does anyone have any questions or comments? Do I have a motion to approve these two policies?
So moved.
Second? Anyone? All right. Go ahead and take a roll call
Cheryl
vote, please.
Boyle.
Yes.
Diana Burleson.
Yes.
Bill Donahue.
Yes.
Greg Fox.
Yes.
Patty Hannon. James Joy.
Yes.
Chaz McElroy.
Yes.
Dave Metzen.
Yes.
Gloria Myrie.
Yes.
Deborah Olson.
Yes.
Sherry Pugh.
Yes.
Tom Stinson.
Yes.
Randy Twistall.
Yes.
Marcia Vandenberg.
Yes.
Ken Wilmes.
Yes.
Laura Whitty.
Yes.
All right, the motion's approved and we have our practices in place. The next item on the agenda is a summary of the constitutional and statutory provisions related to our council, and Ben Weeks will make a presentation.
Hi everyone, I'm Ben Weeks. I'm a legislative analyst and House counsel with the House Nonpartisan Research Department. You all have done this before, and the laws have not changed, the Constitution has not changed, so I'm going to go through it relatively quickly, and then I'm happy to answer any questions I can, or if you have anything you're interested, anything else you're interested about, you let me or Greg know and we can get that for you. So as you may remember, in 2013, the legislature approved a constitutional amendment proposal that would establish this council. That was approved during the 2016 state general election, and that both put the new constitutional provisions in Article 4 and adopted the statutory language in 15A0825 that set up this council and prescribe its duties. Those duties, as Bill said a little while ago, are to prescribe salary for legislatures by March 31st of an odd number of years, so March 31st of this year. The law requires that when you prescribe these salaries to consider, quote, any other legislative compensation provided to legislatures by the to legislators by the state. As you know, the law doesn't define other legislative compensation, but examples are per diem payments, insurance, other fringe benefits, expense reimbursement, housing reimbursement, and the like. The law also requires that you submit a report that, quote, states the reasoning of the council for the salary it prescribed, but doesn't state anything more specific than that. I know in your packet you have a copy of the report that you submitted last year. I think you're free to borrow or reproduce anything from that report that you want to include this year. You could probably reference it in your new report if you wanted to, or really do anything that you want. And then the final law that everyone should pay attention to is the communication prohibition. And that law just prohibits all communication between members of this council and members of the legislature from today, when the first meeting was convened, and through the submission of your report for March 31st, whatever comes later.
And a question came up earlier before the meeting started. So that communication is only prohibited from today till we deliver the report?
Correct.
The question was the first meeting, and was it clear as to whether that was the first meeting 2 years ago?
So It's today.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if anyone had communications before today in this legislative session, that is not an issue.
That's my reading. The prohibition only applies from the first meeting in the new odd-numbered year and the submission of the report on March 31st of that year.
Thank you for the clarification.
That would be a big prohibition.
Well, someone was being cautious.
Yes. Any other questions? I see that we didn't get copies of those laws into the packet for you all, so I will send those to Gray, and so the constitutional provision and the two relevant statutory provisions we can distribute by email later. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Joe.
One question. Yeah, I think I know the answer, but so if we bump into any of the constitutional officers, we can talk to them. It's just the House members and the Senate members.
That's correct. The law just says members of the legislature. So
right.
Constitutional officers, anyone else in the government, it's okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we move on to the legislator compensation data. And there is information that was circulated. And Greg, go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, members, now we start throwing data at you. The first handout is from the legislative reference library that has a history of salaries and benefits for members of the Minnesota legislature. It's blue and black print and shows in the first row, about halfway down the first page, the change that happened to members' salaries as a result of your determination 2 years ago, where the salary went from $31,140 to a new level of $45,000. That same row shows that per diems have not changed since your work 2 years ago. The House continues to pay per diems at $66 per day, and the Senate continues to pay per diems at $86. Just a quick review of other items of compensation. The housing allowance for members who live more than 50 miles from the Capitol has not changed. It's $1,800 per month. That's a reimbursement for expense for rental housing for members. The retirement contributions have not changed. Health insurance, the benefit is the same. Members participate in the state employee program at the same level as any other public employee, where they pay 5% of the premium for employee coverage, employee-only coverage, and 85% and 15% for family coverage. The premiums have increased somewhat since 2 years ago. We can get you details on that if that'd be helpful for you. So that's a quick rundown of that first handout. The second handout is the blue and green table that shows some data about per diems and insurance and expense reimbursements. It's blue and green. The top half is Senate data that we received from Senate staff. It shows, again, that the rate for senators is $86. It shows how much members have received on average for regular session. It's higher in 2017 because it's a long session. It's January to May. The 18th session started mid-February, and so the amount of per diem, the average, was lower. There was some special session or interim per diem that members received. There was no special session, and then the total of those amounts. The middle column shows insurance and retirement, and as I indicated, except for premium increases, there hasn't been any change in that benefit. The third column shows reimbursed expenses. It shows the average lodging reimbursement for those members that are receiving it. Mileage that they receive for the trips to and from their home to the Capitol, other travel when they attend conferences or other meetings. The Senate does not pay for district travel, and then other expenses are typically expenses that they incur in attending conferences.
May I ask a question? As you pointed out, there are significant differences in per diem from 2018 and 17 in both houses. And on the lodging, there's a significant difference for the House, but there isn't for the Senate. Why would that be? The lodging expenses are virtually the $7,187, the $7,269 are almost the same in those two legislative sessions for the Senate.
Madam Chair, I would want to check with House staff. Are you able to talk about that? I'm assuming since they don't have lodging year round and it's a lower reimbursement rate. So Senate members so a member is eligible for a reimbursement for the lodging expenses if they live more than 50 miles from the Capitol.
Right, but
and then some members keep that year round and some keep it only for the months that they're
so in more session. Senate does that than House, since the House has significant.
That's what we believe. We'll confirm that.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, members, the second half of that chart shows the payments for House members. Again, their lower per diem rate at 66 results in lower amounts paid for session, the interim and the other amounts. The insurance benefits are the same. The retirement's the same. We'll check on the lodging, and otherwise they're pretty comparable.
Greg, can you tell us why there's a difference in the cost of health care for Senate versus House members? I mean, one's 18, the other's 19. Why aren't they the same?
Madam Chair and Bill, I'm assuming that the change from 17 to 18 is a result of premiums increasing.
Yeah, don't they have the same health care, though, the Senate members and the House members?
Yes, and the insurance increased the same for the singles. Let's see here.
Yeah, the family coverage is more for the House.
It's an average, and so, it would be based on numbers of family members. I mean, if it's like the ones in my company, if you had... whether you had an individual or a one and children or parents, I mean, there were different premiums for different families' makeups.
I'm
that's
sure
what I'm trying to say.
Family makes difference.
Yeah.
Right.
So since it's an average,
that's the reason.
I don't think that's statistically different.
We'll look at that, about why there's a difference there.
But like I said, I mean,
yep.
Premiums are different for different family makeups.
Let's see. The third handout with data on it is from the National Conference of State Legislatures. This shows basic information about salary and per diem for the 50 states. One step that we haven't done yet is to look at all 50 and see if there have been any changes since your work in 2016. We'll have that done by the next meeting.
Thank you. So this information is the same as we had 2 years ago?
It's parallel to the, yes. And then, Madam Chair, the last handout that staff have is a sort of snapshot on sort of key positions that you have looked at in your work 2 years ago. It's titled Salary Increase Comparisons, Legislative Salary Council 22619. The first category are state offices, the constitutional officers, the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, state auditor. Their salaries have not changed since you last did your work. The members of the judiciary received salary increases of 2.5% each year in 17 and 18. The heads of state agencies, their salaries did not change. State employees, there are 35,000 employees that collectively bargain their terms and conditions of employment. The two categories of salary increases that state employees get are across-the-board increases and then performance-based increases. The cost of living adjustments are fairly consistent across the contracts. They received a 2% increase on July 1st of 17 and a 2.25% increase in July of 18. Employees also are eligible to receive merit increases based on a performance review. Those amounts vary by the contract between 2.75% and generally 3.5%. Employees are only eligible for those increases if they're not at the top of their salary ranges. And across the state and across the contracts, about half of the employees are at the maximum of their ranges, so they do not receive those increases. The other half do. So those increases would be in addition to the ones shown on your chart. Second category, just a snapshot of other legislator salaries. These are the five surrounding states. Basically, there was no change for Iowa, Wisconsin, North and South Dakota, Minnesota. We have a blank there for North Dakota. For they get, only get a per diem. They don't have a salary. We've since checked. In 2016, their per diem was 172. It's now 177, so they received a modest increase. So we'll update this page to reflect that.
I think last time we also looked, Greg, at number of days they were in session. I'd like to see that.
Okay. Good.
And you're saying 0% change in Minnesota. You're saying from when we delivered our report and changed it to.
Good catch.
Because I would say 31,000 to 45 is a substantial change.
A noticeable error. Yes, thank you for that.
Well, I'm just saying.
Since we prescribe it, therefore it's reasonable.
Next category are county commissioner salaries. That was one benchmark that we used. The seven county metro area. There have been some changes there. The percentage changes on the right-hand column varies from 0% for Scott to a maximum of 5.5 for Anoka. When we did our report, we looked, one benchmark that we used was the five-county average, so we excluded Hennepin and Ramsey and just pulled those the other five out. Those, the average of the increase for those five was 2.8%. And then the final benchmark is inflation. Since the council made its recommendations, in the two succeeding years, inflation has increased 1.9% in the first year and 2.7% in the second.
Does anyone have any questions or anything pertaining to these kinds of statistics that you would like to see that is not included in this?
I'd like to know on the CPIU, is that for the Minneapolis-St. Paul Twin Cities area or a general number?
We use the national data for that. Okay. Should we break it down for the Minneapolis-St. Paul? That's easy enough.
Well, it's the whole state, but I was just curious what it was.
Yeah, do we have I think we used national data 2 years ago. We'll check.
Greg, do you have data for private employers and what the percentage increases over the last 2 years are in the private sector in Minnesota?
We don't have that yet. We can certainly try to put something together on private employers.
If you have it, I just don't know if it exists.
I think Deed has some of that kind of data that we could pull out.
I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
Are there any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. This is great to have some updated. Go ahead, Bill.
One other question. And I remember from reading the report, is per diem payments taxed?
The first answer is yes.
But I mean, are they taxed as income?
He's looking around.
Our lifeline left.
Well, you can answer it later. I mean, that's fine.
Helen, why don't you introduce yourself?
My name's Helen Arend. I'm the accounting officer.
Could you speak up for the people on the phone, please?
Oh. Helen Arend, accounting officer with the Minnesota House of Representatives. And the members that are within the 50-mile limit must pay taxes on their per diem. Non-metro area members do not pay tax on their per diem per the 162H provision in the Internal Revenue Code. And they get that non-taxable per diem up to a limit. If they exceed that limit, then their per diem becomes taxable.
So the per diem payments for legislators in the 50-mile radius, they're taxable?
Correct.
And they're taxed by the state and federal
governments
as income. Okay.
But if I recall correctly, they are recognized as income from the standpoint of their pensions and other things. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Session per diem is, and special session per diem is. Interim per diem is not.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Thank you, Greg. I lost my place. Okay. Testimony from former legislators.
So, Madam Chair, we have talked to a number of members, former members, about testifying since you're prohibited from hearing from current members. We weren't able to schedule any for today. We've got one or two scheduled for your second meeting. One question for you is if that's helpful for you and your discussions and deliberations to hear from former members.
And I think let's hold that off. We have a council discussion in general about what we want to do. So is there, I will go to the next item, which is public testimony. Is there anyone here? Please come up to the front and introduce yourself.
My name is Rick Keller, and I represent the Place of Substance people with Practice Attorneys in Minnesota.
Sir, could I ask you to talk up because we do have people on the phone?
My name is Rick Keller. Unofficially represent the twice exceptional people with print disabilities. Minnesota Statute 120B15, you find twice exceptional in it. The print disabilities you find in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 and the ID Act of 2004, special education law, both federal laws. Specific questions about this committee? Hopefully you post your stuff fully accessible. I don't know if this committee complies with Minnesota Statute 16E.03 Subdivision 9, which is technology accessibility law, which is basically 508 and web content accessibility guidelines. Hopefully you'll embed that into your policies this year as it relates to accessibility for the public. Also, there's a bill called 1727. Tori Westrom is offering that. Obviously, Ms. Hortman, I heard she signed on to it, so it's likely going to happen this year. It's an internal group to look. Greg would know about this. I believe it has to do with looking at helping make a legislature more accessible, perhaps include some training to get some feedback and a fiscal note what that's going to cost. Since you are an EEOC, Equal Opportunity Employer, I would think that you would make sure that these documents are not only fully accessible to the public, but you would specifically would hire anybody that's blind or vision impaired. I don't believe the legislature currently does not have anybody in that situation. But maybe perhaps that's why, I don't know. That's something to consider as well. And then I clicked on this link online here to see for more agenda. It's basically what's in HTML. We had handouts today. We were not provided in a timely manner. If you would create a chart, you can have a link, not hidden, but that's fine. But it's a hyperlink, but when it takes you to the same document, if you have handouts, it's, and then last but least, whoever creates especially portal document formats, this document is fully accessible. I did review it with Adobe Reader Reads Out Loud. They started that in 2001. Jay Wyant, I believe Greg here, the LCC, the director, he got a correspondence from the minute. I gave that to him. He can share that perhaps with you. It was over the summer that Jay Wyant, the Chief Information Officer at Minute, put that together. On page 8, it specifically says manually check your documents for the user experience. So what that means is if you're creating a document for whoever has say in the Word and you convert it to accessible, once you create it, you actually go back and review it with the appropriate software. For instance, unless you have the bought in Adobe, which is anywhere from $500 to $700, the free download is free, so if you turn that one off and turn on the free download and go under view, and on the bottom it reads out loud. And specifically in 2008, Adobe put a guide out with the watermark from the Blind Foundation. And on page 9 specifically says, the Adobe Reader is specific for people with dyslexia and print disabilities. So it's not necessarily that we can read now. Can we understand oral English by seeing and hearing it? And that's going to perhaps create more engagement with people with the printed word. Because first you learn to read, and then you read to learn. And the fact is, if we can bypass that, I'll give you one more clue. If you go to Social Security, SSA.gov, Social Security Administration.gov, go down, they do 508, Accessibility Law of Minnesota just does that a little bit more of that. If you go to that, the target audience on that page is not blind and vision impaired. It mentions learning disability, dyslexia, and English second language. And then what it does is marries two sensory gifts that we have to see and hear. It highlights and reads the words out loud. So now it's not that you can read anymore because it's reading to you. The outcome, I believe, is that you can understand oral English for future education, employment, for independent living. That's all I have to say for this committee. Hopefully it's something that you will consider, especially with the training. You may consider that people that get that training, that there's a salary increase because they decided to opt into that. Obviously, it's not going to be mandatory. I don't think they have that. They do have training now. I believe Greg provides. But it can be pretty detailed. Minute has tutoring over there. And it's just Office Enterprise Technology formerly. It does the Minnesota Statute 16E.3. Anybody any questions?
Questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Heller. I appreciate it. Anyone else?
One thing, I would appreciate somebody would send me a packet for today. And Greg has my email. And then from here on forward, you post this stuff and maybe I'll show up. Thanks again. Have a great day.
Thank you. Okay, so we started here with our first meeting. We only have a month to accomplish our goals. And so I think the next item should be a discussion of what this group thinks that we need to be doing in the next couple of meetings, what information you would like them to gather and circulate to us. Right now we have the meeting scheduled 2 weeks from today and 4 weeks from today. If you feel that's an adequate amount of time for us to accomplish our goals. And so I just would like to open it up to discussion to this group as to where you want to go from here, what you think would be most useful, and what information you think we need. So, please.
Deborah, this is Charles McElroy. A couple things in my mind to maybe consider. As we mentioned in our report last time, the per diem policy, whether there's any bills introduced this session. I seem to recall an article about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Yeah. It'd be helpful to maybe have that or talk about that. A chart of the per diem reimbursements the last couple of years. I think there's some online.
I will tell you that I Channel 4 did a story on this a couple weeks ago, and they had a link, so I actually printed out and right off of their web, WCCO TV's webpage, they did a story about this.
Yeah, and how go to that, or maybe.
No, but I'm saying we can
that.
Certainly circulate some info.
And then at some higher levels within the state of Minnesota, maybe what actual per diem policies are, more like in business where rather than a $66 or $86 amount, it's you get reimbursed for your lodging, your meals at a limit, mileage, which I know there is, but some state policies on that. So that if we went down the route of saying, as we did in our report last time, we suggest the legislature get rid of their per diem, maybe have an alternative along with their lodging expenses and things right now. Alternative solution.
If I understand this, you're asking if other state agencies or if the private sector or both of those have
other state agencies
yeah. have policies.
Yeah,
okay,
high
thank
level
you.
State. And what I'm thinking is if we again suggest maybe elimination of per diem and that we offer more detail in terms of what an alternative would be in addition to what they have.
Okay.
This is Dave Metzner. I'd like to support that effort. I think that's, in my mind, the biggest issue facing us right now, and probably the one thing we may be able to make an impact on is that Hobart per diem and the reimbursement procedures currently in practice.
This is Diana Burleson. Just for clarification,
was the raise we recommended included in the budget, and did they actually get it? Because there was a lot of discussion from House Leader Dowd that he was not going to include it in the budget and that he was against it and he would do everything he could not to have it implemented. So whatever happened.
Madam Chair, members did receive the increased salary effective July 1st of 2017. The appropriations to the House and Senate were not increased in the last biennium, so they've so far been absorbing that increased cost.
Was the fact that it wasn't included in the budget sort of that same attempt to say we don't want to take it?
Madam Chair, I don't want to speculate.
No, okay. I understand that. You can't read their minds. I didn't know that it wasn't included later when they had the opportunity. I do remember the media surrounding we're not going to take it and then him backing down and saying that they were. Okay, so yes, they have received it effective July 1st of 2017.
Was there a lawsuit?
But it was not funded through the budget. They have had to absorb the increase through their existing operating budget, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Was there a lawsuit with respect to this?
No.
Madam Chair, there was a suit filed by a member when the former speaker indicated that he was not going to implement the increases. The former speaker, Speaker Dowd, reversed course and implemented the increases, and the lawsuit was
dismissed.
So is it only being absorbed in the House budget? The Senate budget has it in? Or it's just...
Madam Chair, the appropriations to the House and Senate have not changed since
okay.
you made your recommendation.
Thank you for that.
So both are absorbing that cost right now.
Thanks for the clarification. Sherry?
So the per diem figures were senior. This is an average. How does that compare against what the maximum could have been?
How does that compare to what?
Mm-hmm. A maximum.
To the maximum that they could have.
Is there a maximum?
Did they reduce their...
Oh, or how does it compare to 2 years ago before they got theirs?
Because it'd be interesting to see if they reduced their use of the per diem.
Madam Chair and Sherry, we can provide the data that we collected 2 years ago. The overall amounts paid in per diem are higher. What we haven't figured out is that if that's a result of there being more legislative days in 2017 and 18 than there were in 16 and 17.
So you can compile that and
can
circulate that to us.
Try to sort that out.
Okay, so we can see how it compares.
There's also some underlying stuff. Members are not required to take the entire 66 or 86. Some members take the amount that was in place when they were elected and keep that for their entire term, and so they're collecting less than they're entitled to. So that reduces the amount that gets paid.
So you're saying they may have always taken only every day they're in session, but they're taking it at a rate lower than the current rate?
Yes.
Okay.
There's some amount of variability
right.
going on there.
But statistically, I think the interesting point would be how much are they taking now compared to how much they were taking 2 years ago when they were getting substantially less in salary?
Did our recommendation have any impact?
Right.
Yeah. We don't know the answer.
Okay. Other questions, comments, other things you would like to have either on the agenda or information you would like to have presented at our next meeting or other things that you think we should be looking at and discussing?
This is Dave Metzen again. I'd like to see if we can have a great discussion or looking long range. Is there some way that we could abolish committees like this? And
we could abolish what?
Our group or something that would, I'm just throwing out a suggestion, that their salary is tied to Social Security increases or something relative to the budget. I don't think this issue is going to go away because legislators, just by the very nature, are not going to work on not going to increase their own pay. But I do think where we started out 2 years ago, we really want good legislators there. And I don't have the answer, but I'd like to have a discussion Is there some state, there are some place, best practices out there that we could look at and at least talk about a long-term solution to the problem that the state has faced for many, many years?
So, Dave, what do you mean to tie their increases to inflation or Social Security increases or something like that? Is that
Bill, I don't have the answer. I don't have the answer, but I just want to, I'd like to have a conversation with our group. But at least I think we should go on record that we've talked about trying to come up with a long-term solution. I wish I were smart enough to know what that would be financially and politically. But I think we're doing the work we're supposed to do. I really believe we owe it to the public that we've had this discussion.
I respectfully disagree, because we had a constitutional amendment, which is a very big deal. Also, that constitutional amendment approved the legislative
Could you identify yourself?
It's Joe Boyle. I'm sorry, Joseph.
Okay, Joe, thank you. Hi.
In a little town like I live, you forget to introduce yourself. They sort of remember you. but that's right. And that then gets into the per diem argument, because I believe it's much different when you have to drive 250 miles or 200 miles to get here. And that's, to me, the big justification for per diem, which I really think we have to back off trying to change our mandate under the Constitution, because it is the Legislative Salary Council. Now, we are supposed to take other compensation into effect when we set the salary, but that doesn't mean that the first thing we do is destroy the mission that the Constitution, approved by the people of the state of Minnesota, did. And secondly, I think we have to work within the mandate of the legislation and take into account per diem, but that doesn't mean that we run around eliminating per diem. And I really think we have to be careful about that. I also think that if we're going to get legislators here, we have to make sure that we get retired legislators from rural areas, because whenever I've talked to former legislators, so they really wouldn't have an axe to grind about eliminating per diem, they don't really see the same clear perspective that possibly Mr. Metzen does or Mr. McElroy. I just really want to stay within the respect of the job that the citizens of the state did when they put us in the office. That's all.
Thank you.
I'm not necessarily in favor of eliminating per diem, but I understood what we recommended last time was that we pay all actual expenses. So if somebody's driving here from International Falls, that we would always continue to pay that, because that's an actual.
I was talking about the legislative provision. I was talking about the report that we made, not me.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Well, that
that's
was
he's talking about.
That's what the report said, I thought. And it was to protect people who live, in the rural parts of Minnesota, to make sure that their actual expenses got paid, and then to take a look at per diem and figure out what that was and to consider it. And the thing that drives me there is that it looks like compensation because it's taxed. And it doesn't make any sense to me that if it's taxed, we shouldn't just simply add more money to what we pay them rather than pay them per diem.
Well,
and then in addition, we would pay actual expenses so that the rural legislator driving in would have his mileage or her mileage. And in addition, we would increase essentially the salary to account for either elimination of per diem or whatever it is we do. And we can't do it. We can't eliminate per diem. I get that.
And my recollection of our conversations and what the actuality is members are reimbursed for actual expenses. I mean, we discussed this at the time 2 years ago, and looking at this member expense report, they are reimbursed for actual expenses for lodging and travel and things like this. And some of our conversation 2 years ago was the fact that for a variety of reasons. Members take per diem at different levels, and some of that was, it seemed, in the conversations with former members political. Some of them were in less vulnerable positions and thought they could take a maximum versus some who thought that if they took it, it was a politically sensitive thing. So I think we've had a lot of these conversations, and if I recall, the group here did not want to disadvantage anyone from expenses and whatever. They wanted to basically kind of level the playing field or find a fairer system of real pay so that per diem wasn't a piece of it. And someone was trying to speak. James?
They get reimbursed on cell phone and stuff. Is that, is that, Greg, under other expenses? Because they have a cell phone they get reimbursed for, too, on a monthly basis, right?
Madam Chair, Jake, just there's an allowance for cell phone and other telecommunications expenses that they incur, a second phone line.
Would that be net other expenses on here?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And again, I have the advantage of having caught this news thing, so having printed this, but on the headers of this particular member expense report, it has per diem, district travel, lodging, mileage, other travel, other expenses. So, I mean, there are several categories that people get reimbursed. And there are substantial reimbursements, obviously, for district travel and other travel, depending on where people live. So, yes, I mean, put this together and get it out to people so we have something more to discuss. But
I, just for the record, I believe it's important that we have rural legislators, obviously, that are now no longer in office, explain why they think per diem is justified, which I don't believe we had specific testimony from, except Senator Moe, who was a rural legislator, but late in the last 20 years or so that he was involved in the legislature, or the last 10 years that he was involved in the legislature as majority leader, he was down here a lot, and so it was a little bit of a different situation than a typical rural legislator.
And, oh, go ahead.
If the council is going to talk about cost of living, it would be good to have those numbers from July 1st, 2017 forward that we would use.
You're talking about the cost of living?
I don't know if that's in the information.
Index,
provided.
Which is.
Madam Chair, I think that was the last.
That was the 2 point
piece of data on the
one page.
Is that this one?
Is this what you
yeah,
call
this, yeah. Cost of living index.
But that one, I believe, only went to July of last year. So, is there anything that would have for the next, you know, for the 6 months of the end of this year?
We'll have them.
Of 2018.
Oh,
at least that
December.
Chart.
That should be posted by now. Yes.
I would think we need the most current. In addition to what we've been provided. Joseph Boyle, for the record.
If we're done with per diem, I'd like to, I have two things that that are important to me. And one is, I think we should give them a raise. And I think it would be helpful, Greg, if we had data that showed the cost of a raise at 1%, 2%, 3%, and 4%, and you can add other percentages onto that. So that we actually know what that is.
So the total cost.
Yeah, well, the total cost, but do it by percentage of increase, so that you know if we do 1% it costs $50,000, and if we do 2% it costs $100,000,
okay.
That kind of thing. What I want to do is I want to avoid being in the position 10 years from now that we were in 17, where you know they hadn't given themselves a raise for 18 years, and I don't advocate big raises, but fact is that we ought to move them up and keep them either close to inflation or, you know, just below inflation or something like that. The other issue for me, and I raised this last time in the sense of let's give them bonuses if they actually pass a budget in the regular session, and I was told that's not within our mandate. And I don't like that, but I accept that advice from the Attorney General. I think maybe we should discuss whether raises should be contingent on performance. And the only thing of performance that I can think of that really matters is passing a budget during the actual session. I don't know that we should do that, but I'd be interested in having a discussion about that.
Gloria?
This is Gloria Myrie. I don't think that that's within our ability as a consideration. I think the statute sets what we're supposed to consider, and performance is not among those factors.
Ken Walmus, I don't know how we can really judge performance. Just because they pass a budget doesn't mean it's a good one. And it's going to piss off half the people and make the other half happy. So I don't think we can base anything bonuses on performance.
I'll just weigh in from the legal perspective. I've talked with Bill, and my read is the same as Gloria's. I think with the case law indicates salary, it's the fixed compensation for regularly provided services. And because the legislature left intact all the other forms of compensation, I think it's a pretty narrow task. And where if you have opinions to express, it's in the rationale for what you're doing. And this council also can't bind future councils. So whatever you decide, it's for 2 years. So you might express your concern, and it would have been a larger raise, but for this, and then the next council can deal with that information about what happened since the last decision.
But it's a determination of salary. It just makes the determination contingent upon an action, and it would have to be clear, it would have to be objective, it would have to be measurable. And I get it that people are going to be pissed off no matter what happens, but I want them to be pissed off in May rather than pissed off in July after they've shut the government down for 6 weeks and after they've spent more money on per diems for special sessions and that kind of. That irritates me more than almost anything else.
I just don't know how you can judge performance on
Sherry
that.
And then
I'd also like to see if we could get an update. We've had a lot of change in who's in the legislature, and so it'd be kind of nice to get a refresher and see.
Just like number of new members?
Number of new members, gender, income. You know,
demographics.
Last time it was dominated by lawyers. Do we still have a lot of lawyers? Or, you know, do we have single women? We know we have more women at least. But it would just be good to kind of see the change that's happened.
Okay. Joseph?
I agree with Joe Boyle. I agree with what you're saying. We should look at the those type of factors to make sure that running for the legislature is accessible to everyone. I do think that's our mandate. But it isn't to decide what the voter decides in November. Sometimes I really don't understand it myself, but the fact is, that's what their job is under the Constitution. They're the ones that are the big evaluators. Some people want less government. Other people want more government. But that's for the citizens to decide, not this council.
Anybody on the phone that we've missed? Any comments or questions? So at this point, we have a variety of things that we will gather information-wise to circulate before the next meeting, which at this point is scheduled on Friday, March 15th at 9 a.m. at a
different room.
Madam Chair, we weren't clear as staff whether there was consensus about the next
okay.
meeting on the 15th being at 9 o'clock or a different time.
Okay.
That no,
well, okay, let me step back a moment. Oh.
That's not the issue. The issue is we had originally proposed 9 a.m. For March 15th, but since we meet outside of the general Capitol buildings, we're kind of constrained by time limits with these other buildings that are gracious enough to let us use their space. So the meeting room was not available until 10 a.m. So instead of doing 9 to 1, if it went that long, do 10 to
12:30
or 1
okay.
or 2.
Okay, so first of all, we have all the comments that everybody has for information we would like and questions. If things come up in between, please contact Greg and Sally, and if there's any information you'd like. Okay, then the other issue is the next meeting. So it was proposed to have them on March 15th and March 31st. 29th, whatever the, thank you, I can't add today. So is 10 a.m. on the 15th a workable time for this group in general? So no problems with that. So
I will have a problem on the back end.
On the back end if it goes long?
Yes. But I'll
I have a conflict, but I'll work around. Yeah, I'll have to figure it out.
Okay, you could, I mean, if you were come back and you could probably call in and be on some of it or...
I can definitely make it for the first part of it.
Okay.
I'm back at this.
Otherwise, people in general, that's a good date? All right, what about the next date, the 29th, for the final meeting? Is that a good date? That leaves us very, very little wiggle room to get our work done, but does that work for everyone so we can get a report out? Okay, so the hope would be between those two meetings, if necessary, would have a draft report so that the last meeting would be a lot of discussion about what we're doing.
So, Madam Chair, it's thinking about the logistics here. So if we're doing three meetings, at the next meeting we'll have some former members, and we also by law are required to consider the state budget forecast,
right,
so we'll have that presentation. Will you also largely reach consensus about what you want to do so that staff know what goes into the report, so that you can discuss and adopt that report?
It's the only report for the last meeting, so we can adopt it,
right?
So the question is, we will be getting budget figures that, one moment please, that we'll be getting the forecast that day. We will be getting some testimony from former legislators. Will our third or other major agenda item be to have a discussion and hopefully be able to come to a consensus on at least the amount and what we would want in a report so that we could circulate a draft report. Does that seem a reasonable idea that we could do that in one meeting? And you had some comments?
I'm curious about the budget outlook. This is Diana Burleson. Curious about the budget outlook. They ignored the budget the last time we proposed a raise.
It's not in there, so how's that really?
They didn't fund it. They.
Okay.
So what do we need?
just curious.
Just curious.
I mean,
it's a great question.
A couple of ways of looking at that. I mean, the impact on the House and Senate were from the increases for the last round was relatively significant. It was a $2 million per year cost to the House and $1 million for the Senate.
They
were absorbing that, but I understand that they'll be proposing budgets for the next biennium that include those increased amounts. We know what the budget forecast is based on what happened yesterday. Instead of a $1.5 billion surplus, it's now $1 billion. And I think we're negative out in the out years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a cloudier forecast than what we've had since the November forecast. But that's sort of the outline of what you'll hear at your next
meeting. That's a great question. But again, it's kind of out of our purview. I mean,
right.
We are required to look at all this information, make a recommendation, and deliver a report. So stepping back again, do we feel that one more meeting in between now and the end of the month is adequate for us to get the information, have a time to discuss it, and to discuss and, you know, within amongst ourselves what we want to do, or should we tentatively schedule a meeting on the 22nd? Friday seemed to work. Should we tentatively schedule a meeting for the 22nd so that we have more time? Because we do have to deliver this report at the end of the month.
Deborah, I think we should schedule it with the knowledge we could cancel it if we come
right
to an agreement.
But so that people have it on their calendar, so if we cannot complete things in 2 weeks, if we don't have enough time to discuss it, we will have another meeting, whether people can participate by phone or whatever, so that we have an adequate amount of time to discuss it all and come to the consensus, so that you guys would do most of the work, would have the time to do a draft report for us for that. Because the final meeting really is a lot about the draft report and what we want the final thing to look like. We can't just come in and expect it to get done that day.
I agree with that myself.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would like to suggest, I think we should schedule it. We can always, not use that date. But I'd like to suggest that our next meeting, because we all have busy schedules, why don't we add another hour? I think we talked about between 10 and 1. What if, given the number of items we have to address at our next meeting, We put down the possibility of having our meeting from 10 to 2 so people can plan accordingly.
Well, Sally had said that the original schedule was 9 to 1, and we can do 10 to 1.
To 2. I didn't know how long you want the time to be, but I reserved the room from 10 to 2.
Okay, so time frame wise, does that work? Time frame wise, does that work for members if it went for a 4-hour?
Yeah.
I mean, a couple people said they have some issues, but okay, well, let's do this then. Let's schedule the next meeting definitely on March 15th from 10 to 2. We will tentatively hold a couple of hours on the 22nd in case we feel that we need to have another meeting if we haven't come to a consensus or we haven't gotten to the point where we have enough information for them to start drafting a report. And then the final meeting on the 29th would be actually to review the report, tweak it, and get it ready to be delivered.
Just to point, Deborah, I know, and I think we can get this done pretty fast, my opinion is.
Yeah.
I feel that, you know, we seem to come to the consensus and we keep going back to per diems. We're not going to be able to eliminate that. We know that's not out of our deal. That's going to be put in place. I think our focus will be on that 45,000, and if we're going to do a percentage of increase and how that's going to work. We keep falling back to that per diem, which we all have our opinion and opposition on it, but I think if we focus on just what the 45,000 is and what percentage is we're going to increase, I think we could get this done as long as we stay away from all of the makeup, because the makeup, I know we have to put it into our thing, and then we always get back to, well, if we didn't have per diem and we didn't have this, but that really isn't, that's going to get shot down like we did before, so we have to really focus on that 45,000 number and figure out what kind of percentage came, what did Social Security go up, what did cost of living go up, stuff like that, so we have all our facts in place. So when we come to this, I think really our last two meetings, we should be able to, no problem, have this together. My opinion. James Joy.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Charles Macri. I agree with what James says, and I'm wondering if there's time today and interest today in talking about that some.
That's a good point.
So we know what people are thinking when we come back.
I think we should.
And were there some comments over here? I thought somebody else. Okay.
Joseph. Right.
Yes,
Joseph,
go ahead.
Boyle, I agree with, obviously, Mr. Joy, but also I agree with Mr. McElroy. And I would like to vote that we have the meeting on the 15th, the 22nd, and the other date, whatever it is, the 28th. And then subject to cancellation or change. So everybody knows that we have those dates. If we get a lot done after we get done talking now and get a great amount of work done on the 15th, then we can cancel that 22nd one. But I think we're better off to put it in the record and then change it after the fact.
Precisely my point, was just that people held it so we'd have a quorum if we needed it, because I do not want the staff to be overly burdened with them, and they're going to have to put together a report. We're going to have to go through it, and I just wanted to make sure that we had enough time. I agree, since it's the same group, we've had a lot of this. I think that was the advantage for us all, having been on this council 2 years ago. You know, we know what the issues are. We did a ton of work 2 years ago, and I think that it is much easier, and I think it's a good idea if you would like to. I mean, we have plenty of time now. I don't know how much time people had thought this meeting was, but, you know, why don't we take a quick bathroom break, beverage break, whatever, and come back here, and then if we want to discuss a little bit where we're at.
Can we vote on that meeting schedule from 10 to 2?
So we have a meeting scheduled on the 15th from 10 to 2. If needed, people will put on their calendar a meeting on the 22nd, which we may well cancel, and then the final meeting on the 29th starts at 9?
Yes, correct. The 29th would start at 9, and 22nd, or the placeholder meeting, I will try and find something for 9.
Yes, and then after a quick break, we'll just decide how much we want to discuss things before we hear from the legislators and have the forecast, because those are the main pieces that we do not have to have the discussion today. Does that work, or does people want to just keep going?
No, it's
okay.